So I think we're going to zoom back into Salem. And as we close out the tour stops, going to give some time for our panelists to re-engage their video. So all of the presenters that you heard from today, we're going to be available. And we encourage board members to consider the information and welcome any further questions. We do have, I think, probably another 20 minutes for this, 25 minutes, if there's additional questions or considerations, comments amongst board members to discuss the sites spotlighted in today's tour. Go ahead, Ben.
I guess I've got a big picture question, and it seems like a lot of these projects come down to money and where the pot of money is coming from. And we've talked about the department doesn't have really much money to spend on these projects. We're maybe getting some from the legislature, but the lion's share comes from the federal government. And I guess I'm curious, what if any sort of coordinated campaign there is working with our legislative delegation from Oregon on that? That's, I guess, a legislative question, but what can we do? What are we doing, or what could we be doing to work to get more money from the federal government for these projects?
There's a National Association of State Foresters that have state foresters from the 50 states as well as the Pacific Islands. We're active in the Western Forestry Leadership Coalition, which is all the Western states and Pacific Islands. And every year we do propose federal budget increases for the variety of state and private forestry programs, and have worked to do better outcome monitoring. That's what the Forest Action Plans are about, to show the results in a way that resonates not only with Congress, but with the accountants in the Office of Management and Budget, and to be able to really show projects in terms of on the ground progress. So, there are a lot of efforts in terms of long-term funding at the federal level. At the state level, we haven't tried for a while to ask for funding for family forest land assistance because of the budget environment we've been in, and it hasn't been our priority when we're inadequately staffed for the increasing complexities and severity of our fire seasons. You know, in one way, I think the reason we're able to provide the kind of support we did do with the Port Blakely Stewardship Agreement is we are funded for Forest Practice Administration, and the legislature built shared stewardship under the forest practice. So we're able to use our the general fund for forest practices to work on things like stewardship agreement. And sometimes it happens to link up with a federal incentive program. Other times it relies on the interest of the landowner from their own point of view to engage us. And that, I think, is a barrier to including more family forest landowners.
And if I may, we have an absolutely tremendous relationship with our Forest Service and NRCS partners in Region 6. And so we are in contact with them, if not daily, weekly, and they tend to represent us, so to speak. They're interested in the same programs and projects on the ground that we are, and they can, to some degree, speak for us from a regional level back to Washington, D.C. So we are, I think, in harmony with our Region 6 Forest Service partners. We're looking out for each other. We speak for them on occasion, and they speak for us. And that relationship really goes a long way in what kind of funding opportunities we might have.
And I would just add to that, we also have relationships with the Natural Resources Conservation Service, similar to what Jeff described on the federal side, and they help support our incentive programs in our business, the stewardship foresters, and we've also been really creative about creating other relationships with nonprofits and other groups that can, you know, provide leverage funding or other capacity increases for our field staff and projects.
Ben, I don't know how much your question was related to the Good Neighbor Authority, and Carl and I just had a conversation about this, but sort of backing out to the bigger picture, as I understand it, and I don't have the numbers correct, but basically, you know, what's happened over recent decades as we have cut fewer and fewer trees, mostly through attrition, the Forest Service has lost, I believe, something like two-thirds of the staff that they had years ago. And so they literally don't have staff to do a lot of the work that they should be doing and timber sales and that type of thing. So in certain ways, we're backfilling their lack of staffing. And it's a little goofy and crazy, but it's needed. So any comments on that? Do I have that? Am I describing that accurately?
Yep. Brenda, you had your hand up.
And then thanks, Kyle. So first of all, I want to thank the participants. I want to thank the staff for organizing this field tour. And I truly want to thank the people who, you know, from Port Blakely and Lindsay and Jeff for providing these examples. They're really great and found them to be very interesting. So what I'm about to say is I want to have that be front and foremost. What I'm struggling with here is scale. And these are great examples of some good steps forward to address some key issues, such as fire-adapted forests and biodiversity conservation and clean water. But what I'm not seeing is the big picture, as Ben just described it. What is ODF doing? What is the forestry community at large doing to collectively address some of these issues? And I was fascinated by Mike's referral to Washington in several instances. And I'm not suggesting that Washington has that all figured out by any means, with due respect to my colleagues in Washington, but it seems like they are doing some things that we are not, that provide for some more certainty around forest operations, but from the federal standpoint, more certainty around biodiversity conservation. And so it would help me, I think, to understand how these efforts that were described today fit into that big picture of addressing some of these large scale issues, including climate change and carbon storage, going forward, so that we can see 20, 50, 100 years down the road, how we're gonna get there and still be able to address these issues.
Panelist, who wants to tackle this one?
Well, I will comment very quickly on the various planning tools that we have. And I've mentioned the FPFO and the Forest Action Plan, the Governor's Wildfire Council, the Shared Stewardship Agreements, MOUs, all very worthwhile. But at times, I find when we're looking at various funding sources and land ownerships, not any one of those documents necessarily captures all of the nuance that we might be looking at when we're trying to build a complete picture for the long term. And so, potentially, I wouldn't imagine we'd create a new planning document. but potentially there's something that is more overarching than what we have in place now.
And if nobody else wants to weigh in, I will weigh in. The document that should be saying this should be the forestry program for Oregon, which is a 20-year vision for what Oregon's forest should be. And if I recall, there isn't anything about landscape scale planning or treatment or using that sort of global perspective, large landscape perspective. You've read it most recently, Jim. Is that part in there that you recall? Sorry, put you on the spot.
I may have missed that.
I don't think you did. So it is is intended to be the vision that drives us. So, but Lindsay has her hand up. And so maybe she wants to answer. I'm sorry, I just saw that.
No worries. How do I take my hand down? There we go. I think I got it. So I really appreciate that question because it's also something I've been thinking about is how much resources came into our 670-acre, quote, small tree farm, which for me is not small, but for on the larger landscape scale. And I know when I was working with Jennifer and some of the other folks in this project, there's, I think, a broader context that is sometimes not seen with the conductivity that the owl has with our tree farm. And as I had mentioned in my story, you know, the number of board feet that were not cut. So for me, that is a statement of a small landscape that has maybe a bigger picture in the future. And for me personally, one thing as, you know, Peter's seen me with the kids is one of my goals is to bring more people out to a working tree farm and see how a working tree farm works right next to a conservation easement. And who knows where that information will go towards of a future forester or a future person that really understands the nature of Oregon's forests on this landscape scale, but maybe starts asking the questions that kids are not asking about. How do we conserve our forest land? How do I look at a stream and understand the complexities of that ecosystem? So I think sometimes it's a great question, but the answer might be something we can't answer for another 30, 40, 50 years, because I've just somehow engaged a young person in an opportunity to say, oh, I now understand Oregon's forests in a different way. One thing I didn't get a chance to share, because I could go into the schools and have had opportunities that most of us know this, kids are forest illiterate. They don't get into the woods. They don't smell nature. And one girl got off the bus and said, oh, it smells odd out here. And so the more I think that we just engage kids and adults, even if it's a university student, on our landscape and help them to understand what we're doing. Yes, it might be on a small scale, but the future generation is losing this natural resource opportunity. A kid K through 12 can go through school and not learn anything about Oregon's forests, but they seem to learn about the forests down in South America and then bring that conservation effort to a misunderstanding of what we're doing in Oregon's forests for the social and the environmental and the economic opportunities. And the other piece that Forests Today and Forever, the nonprofit I work towards, and this is another piece that's my concern, is we need to get more people working in the woods. And we are losing that opportunity. So when it comes to folks knowing how to run a chainsaw, being out there fighting fires, having the opportunity to know what it's like to work in the woods, log trucks, we have a hard time getting a log truck anymore because people just are not, after the 2008, a lot of people went out of business. So it's kind of I'm trying to give a 30-second elevator speech to Brenda's question. I think it's a great question. And I think there's other opportunities that question maybe doesn't address when it comes to the engagement that Oregonians have with our forests.
Mike, did you have a question or did you want to add to this discussion?
I'll respond to the question. I think that there's a lot of work that can be done with small landowners in Oregon. There's a big piece of forest land out there that's controlled by a lot of people. And maybe there's some collaborative something that can be done across more, you know, not individual tree farms, but within a drainage or a region or a county. There can be something of a programmatic stewardship agreement for small landowners in a particular area. You know, that's one way you could get some more scale. Because I agree, you know, this is good. We're creeping along, and we probably need solutions that are going to do more. When you talk about things like climate change, you know, we've done a lot of work analysis on what are we going to do about climate change, and it's particularly what role the natural and working lands play in that discussion. And the unfortunate fact is the number that matters is flux, and flux is going the wrong way on the national forests. You know, we really need to figure out a way to address the areas where we have potential for sequestering atmospheric carbon, and it's not happening. And, you know, I don't own a sawmill. Our company doesn't have a sawmill, so I don't really, you know, I'm not interested in federal timber for my own use, but as someone that just cares about the amount of atmospheric CO2 and equivalent, I would really like to see a healthier environment in the national forest. And those of us that are in the business of growing trees for a living are, you know, we're firing on all cylinders with things like assisted migration. We think about, you know, when we're planting a tree today, we're taking a seed source from 100 miles south because we know that things are going to get warmer. We need a tree that's more drought stress adapted, and so on and so on and so on. Those trees can't move themselves. And if the climate is changing faster than a Douglas fir can comfortably adapt, you're going to have to do something. And we're not doing anything, or we're not doing nearly enough. So, you know, stewardship agreements are great, but we've got to do something about that. You know, the Good Neighbor Authority is a big passion of mine because of that. But, you know, I think something has to be done on the federal ground. If you want to have the most impact in the least amount of time, that's where you're going to start.
I like your thought about a programmatic stewardship agreement across multiple owners. I have, you know, Nate's probably glaring at me, but I'm going to ask Jeff to talk about the Chiloquin, because we've done that with fuels reduction plans across multiple ownerships, haven't we, Jeff?
Yes. I'm not terribly familiar with that, but I do know that there's various programs that have been accessed to treat large acres around Chiloquin. And one nice thing about that is that it goes beyond just one or two landowners, and one engagement that we find to be extremely effective is Walker Range, an association down there, and local folks are working locally on their own properties if given the correct tools. And so, Peter, I might not get exactly to your planning message here, but I think if we offer tools, I mean specifically chippers and training and, you know, that type of expertise to local communities, they will engage very quickly. I think one of the boundaries or one of the way that they engage is by learning and being given the tools to go out and correctly do a project. And we've seen that blossom into a very large scale in that community.
So one last thing, I hear about Washington doing things and California doing things that we're not. And they are certainly investing a lot more public general fund into fuels reduction than the state of Oregon does. But then I think California is the fourth largest economy in the world, and Washington is, with the Seattle port, is much wealthier as well. But one thing that Oregon has, it's given us a chance to be able to move much more forward as we think about the forestry program for Oregon, is our land use system. We have 98% of our wildland forest that we have in 1974. So when you think about a landscape scale, we have the opportunity on a landscape scale to preserve much more forest than our northern and southern states have, where they've had the much more massive urban sprawl than Oregon has experienced. And that goes hand in hand, as it talks about the forestry program for Oregon, with a regulatory system and voluntary measures to produce outcomes. And one thing that we really don't want to do is risk our history of conservation in terms of keeping forests as forest. So I think we're actually positioned to do really well.
I'd like to make a comment. Mike, sometimes it's hard to get something through my noggin, but thinking about how much you've stressed the importance for a company like yours to have regulatory certainty. Why would you want that? You're growing trees. they do take a while. With that in mind, I think we're all very hopeful about the MOU and the possible HCP for private forests. But I think you're also pointing out that that is one piece of the pie. And the other piece of the pie is our Forest Practices Act. And what I'm hearing, correct me if I'm wrong, that looking at the example of Washington, that strengthening the Forest Practices Act in ways that conservationists would want can be to some degree a reasonable trade-off for landowners if we include the kind of regulatory certainty that you've achieved through your agreement. Comments on that?
Well, I am a member of the MOU group, so it's probably not appropriate for me to comment on anything that's happening in that group. But I think generally I can say that we really I haven't met a forester in the state of Oregon that doesn't want to do the right thing on the ground. You've got people that care very much about their profession. You don't get in this business because you have to be, to some extent, an environmentalist. So I feel like you've got really smart people at that table. They're going to come up with some good solutions. I've also been a lot of other places in the world and seen what forest practices look like there. And I can tell you that the fact that you have a primarily forested landscape in the state of Oregon that has been the backbone of the economy in a lot of areas, and you've got second and third generation forests that are still, well adapted and growing well. You've got a lot of good things to celebrate here. I don't think that just trading, buffer widths for HCPs is an answer. I think you really have to think about what do you want to accomplish with the whole system? And I happen to also be a believer in system theory. And, all parts of that system have to be working, including the economic part. I don't think Washington did everything right. There's a lot of stuff up there that we're still arguing about. And, we will continue to argue about. But the fact that everybody's at the table and everybody's talking and that people have good ideas and they're willing to listen to each other is what makes us work. You got to think about the number of people that are living in Arizona right now that eventually it's going to get to the point where there aren't enough tolerable days in Phoenix, and they're going to want to move north. And you're going to have in the next 50 years an influx of people wanting to come to Oregon. And that investment in timber, that active timber business, is one of the best lines of defense you have against conversion. And I really, I believe that. And there's a lot of people there's a lot of data to back that statement up. So, I'm not going to tell you that I have that answer. I'm just glad that people are talking. We're having good conversations, and you're going to see, I think, some really productive stuff come out of it.
Thank you.
Yeah, can I just add one thing? I didn't put my hand up. Sorry about that. I wanted, Mike talked about what's happening in our federal forests and just as a forester's perspective, and Ben and I, Jim added to mention the fact the Forest Service has lost a lot of their staff and their ability to do a lot of this work. The other thing that's happening in Eastern Oregon is we're losing all of our infrastructure. And, Lindsay talked about it, mentioned log trucks. When you begin, and we're losing those tools. I mean, we're frankly are losing those tools. We're losing the mills, we're losing the loggers, we're losing the people that are working in the woods. We're losing that ability. So I see the same thing. And I just had a chance last spring. I spent some time up around Granite, looking at just, recreating, and as looking at those federal forests or a forester's lens, all I see is massive fires. That's what I see. That's what I see the future of those areas as being. And it's really very, very troublesome as an Oregonian, as a forester, to see that. And I don't know, how we get that scale, how we begin to move that dial, but some way we've got to do that. And harvesting has to be a part of that. That I heard a quote the other day, conservation without funding is just conversation. And it is, it's without that. And harvesting has to be a part of that. Conservation has to be a piece of it. And anyway, I'll get off my soapbox, but as a forester living in Eastern Oregon, it scares me what's happening in our federal lands.
Carla, did you have a comment? Sorry.
Yeah, I think with a problem this big, there's no one magic bullet or no one magic program. We need that conservation piece. But it's clear there's pieces coming together that are critical. And I think we have, many of those pieces together. What we don't have is the dollars and the labor force, but the labor utilization rate is low enough in rural Oregon that there's programs and incentives to gather that as well. I think, yesterday the Oregon Senate went on record saying we need more help from our federal delegation and the federal government, knowing, 85-86% of these fires are on public lands. And I wonder at what point, Peter, that, this board needs to be very intentional about, recognizing that as well. And, not just public resources, but also how do we incentivize private capital and resources to help tackle this problem? I think we need to think, beyond these agreements and have a real thoughtful strategy if we're going to meaningfully attack some of these bigger issues.
I think that's really interesting in the I know that Governor's Wildfire Council touched on that a little bit about the public-private partnership. Where we've seen them occur, there's been more natural connections, like with water providers in Denver, Colorado, that were directly impacted by fires. So I think that is part of the solution, and that's a tough nut to crack in terms of how does that partnership between public and private emerge.
And Lindsay, you have your hand up.
There we go. Thank you. Yeah, I just want to kind of add a couple of quick comments regarding my opportunity to work with ODF and Small Woodlands. And there's been many times at the Oregon Logging Conference where I've had a booth and had a small woodland person come up and say, well, it's my land, I can do what I want. And that's a common theme I also hear from kids. Oh, it's my land, I can do what I want. So I think I would just encourage the board to remind us all that small woodland owners are of land ownership in this state, and people coming into the state buying land might have that same concept without understanding the forest practice rules. And also then when disturbance happens or fire happens, how do small woodland owners access the resources? I had a lot of people call me up after the ice storm. I need, two loads of logs taken out. They're not going to get a contractor that's going to come out and take out two loads of logs. So I just kind of want to give a voice out for the small woodland owner that we need that educational effort as well. And as we have more and more people coming into the state, buying forest land, not understanding the rules and the regulations, that could be a huge aspect for stream health, bug beetle infestation, everything that goes along with owning forest land. Thank you.
And Brenda, you had a question or comment? You're muted, Brenda.
Thank you, Kyle. So this is a great conversation, and I really appreciate all the different perspectives. The only thing I wanted to add is that I think it's important to come back to the science behind a lot of these issues, and particularly around climate change. You know, Mike's point about flux is a good one if we're focusing on carbon sequestration. If we're focusing on carbon storage, then you know, the majority of the federal lands are storing the majority of the carbon in forests at the moment. Yes, some of them are vulnerable to fires, but even after a fire, there's still a lot of carbon stored, both in the dead wood as well as in the soil. And the carbon storage capacity on the east side is not as great as it is on the west side. So, you know, there are just a lot of nuanced pieces to these questions that we need to be taking a close look at and using the best available science to try to understand how to put all those pieces of the puzzle together to address these issues at a very large scale. So I'll just stop there. But I think we just need to be careful not to generalize too much.
Any other questions or comments? If not, I just want to thank the presenters. Mike, you and your team did a great job. Everybody did a lot of amazing work on this virtual tour. And I think we've got about 8 minutes left for any closing comments from Chair Kelly or board members or Peter.
I would also like to thank the tour host and the staff here at ODF. And I got an email from Hillary, and I want to especially thank her updating me on the last of the meetings. I was not able to attend all the planning meetings for this board tour. And I said, well, I'll just zip through that thing. And I realized that there were 21 pages I had to get through to get to the most recent modification and improvement on the tour. And that reflects over probably a year's worth of work that Claudine was instrumental in, everybody, Nate, Kyle, all figuring out how to pull this off. And so kudos to everybody, and particularly to Port Blakely for the long-term commitment to do this tour and to do it virtually because we were still in a pandemic. So thank you all very much. Excellent work.
I'll do the third round of thank yous here on behalf of the board. Thank you, presenters. We really appreciate, you know, all of you have lots of other priorities and lots of other work to do, both the staff here as well as the presenters. So we're really deeply appreciative that you took the time with us and all the work that went into this. Thank you.
I would just echo that. This is my first board meeting, and I'm impressed with all the work that went into this. And this is, I'm honored to be in this group. So thank you all very, very much.
Okay, we are through that formal part of our agenda here, and we really want to just open it up here for a few minutes for final comments from State Forester, anyone else who's got comments on really anything throughout the day. This is our time for a little bit of open and less structured conversation.
Questions. Nothing from the Port Blakely team, Kyle.
What was that?
I was not sure how this meeting was going to turn out, and I am really pleased with the level of engagement we got throughout this meeting. And I think we all learned a little bit about each other. I learned things about my executive team that I did not know. And so it was a very good meeting for me. So thank you all for participating.
Don't all jump in at once. Anything that was missing today? Anything that was you expected? I'm looking at you three new board members. Well, somebody at some point said, I agree with everything that's said. And I was thinking to myself, well, that's the last time that'll be happening. That might have been you, Ben.
Now, Jim, you need to be the optimist.
I just think there's a lot for all of us to learn as new board members. These are really big programs that are, coming to us in vast volumes of, when I see 900 page documents, there's a lot for us to absorb. So our learning curve is very, very high. And I think, I think the tone and the willingness of all of us as board members will learn it as quick as we can. I also think living in rural Oregon, people are more concerned about the environment today than any time I remember. They're concerned about, the smoke, human health, and these fires, and it's just more complex and it's on a much larger scale than it's ever been in our lifetimes that we're aware of. But it also seems very dangerous and threatening when you are in rural communities and you see these fuel loads at levels that we haven't experienced before. And, when we're not managing fuel loads in canyons or not managing fuel loads on some of these government lands, it puts people in these rural communities and as neighbors in a very different situation than where they've been before. And so I just think it's so important that we listen and make sure that we're factoring in not only the health of all Oregonians, but our firefighters. And, we have them on the front line and in a highly unusual situation. So I just thank the, department for their leadership and, what they're doing in this entire arena, and our learning curve is high, but I think we've got to make greater progress.
I just want to give a shout out. Thank you for having a small Woodlands person on our board. I really appreciate that voice. And if he or anybody would like to reach out to myself and talk about small woodland ownership concerns, considerations, please feel free. Happy to engage in those conversations.
I'd love to connect. I think we have a lot in common, a lot to talk about.
Yeah. And I've been following what you're doing. So, I don't have as many hardwoods as you do, but just really appreciate the board getting a small woodlands person. They actually asked me to be on the board and I looked into that and I'm like, maybe not quite yet. So today's been a great day for me to kind of watch the process, and happy to engage with anybody at whatever level they would like.
We really welcome Ben and what he represents, but I think there's some credit that should go to one or two state senators who felt very strongly about having a small woodland owner, and they were really the ones responsible to make sure that we've got that representation on the board.
Thank you very much. Wonderful.
Jim, if I could, I'd just like to point out that reiterate a point that you made earlier, and that is, by statute, each of us needs to represent all Oregonians. And I completely, having grown up in a rural environment as a kid and spent most of my life in rural environments, I appreciate the risks that Carla mentioned. But by the same token, we also need to appreciate the views and values of people who live outside of forests, but who use forests for a variety of things. and who experience the smoke intrusions and who experience other aspects of forests. Yes, I appreciate Lindsay's work in terms of getting kids into the forest. I think that's outstanding. But the fact of the matter is there's going to be a lot of kids that never get into a forest, and they're going to grow up and they're going to have views about forests. And we need to listen to that too. So I just want to, you know, from the standpoint of diversity, equity, and inclusion, recognize that there are communities in our states who have views and values that we don't often hear from.
Another thought I have, kind of on a different subject, but I think it's important to be thinking about as board members, and that is what our authority is and what our authority is not. And the big problem is that there tends to be a lot of confusion in the public and sometimes amongst stakeholders around that authority, because there's things that were either statements about what our authority around forest policy and all, and but and it ends up sounding to a lot of folks like we are in fact more powerful than we are in certain ways, because a lot of times power is expressed through dollars, through funding, and you know we are a policy board, and so you will see over and over the public or portion of stakeholders clamoring for why don't you do this board of forestry. Very sometimes those are things that are clearly within our authority. Sometimes they are constrained by the constitution of the state, and sometimes and very often constrained by a lack of funding. And so, you know, I think we need to all be clear-headed and learn exactly around that authority so that we are able to clearly communicate as we get those requests and not add to the confusion in any way, because you're going to see plenty of it. Does that seem right, fellow old board members?
Yeah, I agree, Jim. It's there is confusion, especially amongst stakeholders, sometimes to our authority, and you'll likely run into that with stakeholders and the public reaching out to you. And so, I guess that's just an FYI. I guess I would say I am optimistic. I'm much more optimistic than I was when my first board meeting. I'll just say that. We talked about the tone and about our discussion about learning about each other. And so I am very optimistic about the future. I'll just leave that as my final comment.
Thank you. I think I'll do my final comment as well. And I wanted to thank the panel and staff again as well. I think this has been really instructive, and echo Carla's comment that, you know, we are on a learning curve. So thank you everyone for indulging us. I think as we continue that, I think what's been illuminating for me, and it started with this concept of how a board functions, right? And we talked about overarching planning and the forestry program for Oregon, and then we got to see these very specific tools. And then we had questions about, you know, what are the scale of these tools and how do they fit back into those overarching goals and objectives? And I think those are all really important points and just illustrate how important it is for us to be clear, right, about what we're trying to do in an overarching sense, and then have the different metrics and then have the tools and then link back and explain how the tools are advancing the metrics or whether they're doing that. And so for some of these things, they're being, you know, we have these tools and they're being used on a relatively small scale, but do we have a way to track those their effectiveness and whether or not they're the right tools for us to be pushing? Like, do we need more funding for these things or not? Do we want that? Do we need to make improvements? Are there other ways that we should be increasing the pace and scale? And I think we've had those threads of conversation. You know, is science driving these priorities when we're thinking about our tools also? I think they're just very important threads, and I'm hoping that we're able to, you know, get into that with our planning. And I'm hoping that we're going to be able to be really clear with our stakeholders about what we're trying to do and what programs and policies and tools we are using to do it. And I'm looking forward to continuing those conversations. So thank you.
You know, I really believe in organizations being outcome focused, and part of our planning process, we'll be looking at measurements, of course. The sad part about that, and the real conundrum, and probably why we get paid the big bucks, is in a whole lot of spheres, you can measure outcomes in pretty short order, months, years, and we are dealing with outcomes that are often decades, generations apart. And I wish it wasn't that way. I wish it was easier, but that's our reality here. That's just it.
I used to always tell my students, it's not rocket science. It's a lot more complicated.
If we don't have to fill the time, I would love to be able to go home a little bit earlier than planned, but also want to make sure that anybody who still has a opportunity for a comment has that opportunity. A moment of silence, and then we're going to be adjourned here. Otherwise,
okay, Jim, I'll break the silence. But I'll keep it very short.
Okay.
I am typically not the optimist in the crowd, full disclosure. But I have to say that this discussion today, where we've talked about our past, and we've talked about our own views about going forward and the magnitude of some of the issues that we're grappling with, I have to say that I am optimistic that this is a great group of people. And if we work together, and I'm sure we will, we're going to be able to tackle some of these things. And the forestry program for Oregon is certainly the overarching compass that we need to send us in the right direction. So I really have enjoyed meeting you all virtually today, and I look forward to where we're going to take this thing.
Well, that sounded very reasonably optimistic, unlike my pathological optimism. I just one more time want to really thank the staff and the executive team and Hillary and her team. This step in the onboarding process has been, it's just such a night and day from when we came on. And can't say enough kudos to all for what's been done here. So we do are left with reasons for optimism. With that, we are adjourned.
Thank you, everyone.